Hey guys, thanks for joining us for this 159th episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. Special guests on this episode include video game creator Warren Davis. We'll be talking about his book, Creating Q-Bert and Other Classic Video Arcade Games. We'll talk with actress and TV host Jill Wagner about her new movie, A Christmas Miracle for Daisy, which is available December 11th on GAC Family. We'll also visit with actor and country artist Alexander Ludwig. Got a new movie, National Champions, in theaters on Friday. And we'll also visit with director, writer, and producer Chris Johnson and Mariana Tosca. We'll be talking, since it is Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, we'll visit about their documentary Journey to Royal, a World War II rescue mission. Of course, if you would, please take the time to subscribe, comment, leave some feedback, check out the shop, and of course, share with your friends. Now, if you're like me, you might gain a little weight over the holidays, and your dog just might too. A new study found even our dogs overeat this time of year, but obviously it's our fault, not theirs. Over 70% of dog owners admit to giving them more table scraps during the holidays, and 80% have even given their dog a special holiday meal around Thanksgiving or Christmas. Now, it also looked at which family member is most likely to sneak them some food under the table. And it's basically a four-way tie between my mom, my dad, my spouse, and me. I'm going to geek out a little bit. We're going to talk about a new book coming out December 21st. It's called Creating Q-Bert and Other Classic Video Arcade Games. We've got developer, now author, Warren Davis with us. And first off, Warren, appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure to be here. I really appreciate you having me.
Now, what was it that made the book become a reality now as opposed to any time before, Warren?
Yeah, well, now it's been a long genesis, I should say, getting here. I probably had the idea for the book, 5 or more years ago. I was attending a lot of these retro gaming events, which are popping up all over the country. Every major city has one. And I was telling my stories, which was, I was just amazed that people were interested. These are things that happened to me decades ago, but people did seem to be interested. And I thought, wow, I started to realize just how many stories there were. So I thought maybe collecting them into a book would not be a bad idea. I was seeing a lot of stuff about video game history being written, but I wasn't seeing a lot of it being written by the actual people who had done the work. And I thought, maybe a firsthand account would be a good idea. So also it gives me an opportunity to get it right. I was seeing things where people kind of got it slightly wrong. And I thought maybe I could write my own account. So it was a long process, though. First, there was a couple of years of just sort of thinking about it and trying to figure out could I do it? And do I know enough? And will I be accurate enough? And then there was a couple of years of actually doing it and writing it, putting it on paper. And then I went through a period where I self-published a couple of years ago. And then the pandemic happened. My plan was to take my self-published book to shows and stuff. But then in my boredom, sitting around during the pandemic, doing absolutely nothing, I thought, well, maybe I'll reach out to some real publishers and see if I can get any interest. And strangely, I did. I found the Santa Monica Press was interested. And so it's been a year-long process working with them to re-release it. Now it's about to come to fruition.
And Warren, what is the biggest thing that you see is developing the games back in the 80s and 90s as opposed to today? I mean, are they that much alike and are they also that much different, if you will?
Well, they're obviously very different in the complexity of not only the gameplay, but the graphics and the visuals. There's so many things that, so many experts you need. Back in the day, we only had three people making a video game. You had your programmer, you had your video graphic artist, and you had your sound designer. So it was a much simpler thing. It was easier to communicate. Coordination amongst the team members was a lot easier. But, I think the way things haven't changed is in people using their imagination to envision new experiences for an audience. Certainly the industry has grown to the point where there are a lot of, you know, standard genres and maybe rehashes of the same old thing. But there kind of was that back in the day. As soon as anything was established as a new genre, you'd see a lot of it and a lot of repetition. But I think imagination is something that will never go out of style.
How much pride do you take in being part of the early generation of games that just blew up? And like you mentioned, so many different genres available now. I'm sure you probably never even imagined those when you started, did you?
I do think, and this is, hard, maybe it's hard to believe, but, I think a lot of us in the industry did envision where the industry would go. I think we all envisioned a future of basically interactive movies. I think we all envisioned a future, of realistic graphics. It's just we didn't know how to get there and we didn't know when it would get there. But I think everybody, back in the 80s, there was always science fiction. So you would imagine things that were absolutely impossible or seemed impossible. What's amazing, I think, is how quickly they became possible. To see a modern game is just phenomenal. As far as bragging rights and pride, yes, I was very proud to have been part of it. I do feel like I was just in the right place at the right time. It was a kind of dumb luck, if you will. But but bragging rights is pretty much all I have, actually. didn't reap any rewards, but that definitely a huge degree of satisfaction, not only in what I was able to accomplish, but just the fact that people still remember it fondly today. It's very gratifying.
Now, for you, which one of the ones that you worked on is Qbert the one that you hang your hat on, if you will?
Well, truth be told, my favorite game, the game I think I'm the most proud of was a Laserdisc game that I made called Us Versus Them. Also for Gottlieb, came out after Qbert. It was sort of a groundbreaking game because it incorporated scenes with live actors and flying footage where we had superimposed computer graphics over the flying footage to give you the illusion of battling aliens in the sky. And it was kind of groundbreaking visually, but it came out at a time when the laser discs were found to be not ready for prime time. And so people were suddenly, because there was a huge laser disc craze in 1984, 1983, 1984, and then the bottom just fell out. And that's exactly when Us Versus Them, this game, was released. So unfortunately, never got the widespread release that we were hoping for.
That's cool. Now, the book we talked about coming out on the 21st, Creating Qbert and Other Classic Video Arcade Games. Warren, I want to make sure and let our listeners know where they can pre-order the book and also keep up with everything else you've got going social media-wise as well, sir.
Sure. The book's available, anywhere books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can pre-order it right now. If you have a favorite independent bookseller, I believe you could order it from their website. What was the second part of that question?
Social media, if anybody wants to keep up.
I'm not a huge social media guy. Sorry, but I am on Twitter at Warren Davis 29. And I do have a public Facebook page, which is facebook.com/WarrenDavis29. People can keep in touch with me there.
All right. Well, Warren, been playing your games for most of my life. It's a privilege to have the chance to visit with you. I can't wait for the book to come out, and hopefully we'll catch up next year, my friend.
That would be fantastic, Cameron. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that.
Santa's got 2.5 more weeks to prep, and then one really tough work day. Now, someone talked to hundreds of kids and asked how they think that Santa gets through all those houses in one night. And here are the 10 most popular theories. Number 1, special keys that can open any door. Number 2, he uses the chimney. Number 3, magic. Number 4, teleportation. Number 5, he can walk through walls. Number 6, he just moves really fast. Number 7, lots of help from his elves. Number 8, he can freeze time. Number 9, he puts everyone in the world to sleep. And number 10, gift stations set up in every country so he doesn't have to carry everything with him. And the poll also found that 40% of kids have seen Santa and 42% have heard him up on the roof before. Do you remember her from Wipeout? Also got a new Christmas movie to talk about, A Christmas Miracle for Daisy. That's available on GAC Family. And Jill Wagner on the line with us. And Jill, always great to visit with you, my friend.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Now, Jill, tell us about the new movie that's available now. It premiered, actually premiering Saturday. I'm sorry, I got my dates turned around here. A Christmas Miracle for Daisy. Jill, tell us about the new project.
Yeah, no, this one's a really special one. I'll say not only because I just about 3 months ago had a little girl named Daisy. So I think that it's special because it's a little bit, I would say, more real than the other Christmas movies that I've done, in meaning that I think that sometimes people at the holidays, it's not necessarily the most happy time for some people, and they've experienced loss. And in this movie, there's a little girl named Daisy who has lost her parents, and Connor, who is played by Nick Bateman, he adopts them. I'm sorry, he adopts her, and so her dream or her wish is to have her have a mom and to complete her family. And it's about her story and about her connection with my character Whitney, and it's just this beautiful love story between those two, as well as Connor and Whitney. Because obviously there's always the love story between the two main characters, but this time we added in this little girl who Ruby Tupper plays her, and it was her first movie, and she just does such a brilliant job. She's just so adorable in it, and so yeah, I'm really proud of this one. And it does have a happy ending, just so everybody knows.
It's not all darkness.
No, it's not all darkness. It's actually a really sweet movie, but I think it's important to realize that sometimes, you know, not everybody, it's not all, you know, Santa Claus and bows for people during the holidays.
And Jill, for you, how much different do the holidays look now as you've got a 2-year-old and a 3-month-old? How much different does the holiday preparations look like for you?
Oh gosh, it's completely different. I think it's lovely. It's like seeing Christmas again through my eyes as a child, right? So it's like there's nothing better than seeing the holidays through a child's eyes, period. It's just everything is new, and you know, it's the magic of Christmas. I think that sometimes you can lose when you become an adult because everything gets so stressful. And a child doesn't have that, right? A child just sees the magic of it all, whether it be Santa Claus or, you know, the gifts. I mean, I think when they're old enough, I will start to explain for me what the true meaning of Christmas is with Jesus. But that's, you know, it's all magic. It's all wonderful. And you know, it's just a great time to spend with your family. And so it's great for me when my dad and my mom get to come in and see my girls, because that makes me happy as well.
Now, how has having two youngsters of your own now, how has that changed your working schedule, and how much juggling have you had to learn?
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know that it's changed my schedule at all. Like, I'm still pretty much full speed ahead, but it's made it more difficult for me, because even when I had to leave Daisy, I guess it was 3 weeks after I had her, I had to go to Vancouver and film. And, you know, that was the hardest thing I've ever had to do, mainly because she was my new baby and, you know, I hadn't really had a chance to bond with her that much, but I knew that I was doing it for her. So that was, you know, that's what kept me going. But it's a little difficult to try to figure out, okay, are they going to be with me on set or are they going to stay home? But it's but it's kind of what I've been used to my whole life is juggling. So, you know, it just makes it a little more complicated. But, you know, they always know that mom's coming home, and the reason I do this is for them. So.
That's cool. Now, GAC Family is where folks can check out the new film. And I want to let folks know about GAC Family if they haven't heard of it before, Jill.
Yeah, GAC Family is this awesome network, and it's not necessarily new, but it's rebranded by Bill Abbott, who used to be the CEO over at Hallmark. And so if you love Hallmark, you'll love GAC Family. It's just going to give people another avenue to see all of these great films. And also with my film in particular, you're going to be able to see it on Amazon Prime as well. So I know the people who are in Canada or internationally, actually, you're going to be able to see it Amazon Prime, which is great.
That's cool. And again, the movie, A Christmas Miracle for Daisy. Jill, I want to make sure and let folks know where they can find not only more about the movie, but everything you've got going social media wise and upcoming works as well.
Yeah, it's, just check me out on Instagram. I'm really vocal on Instagram. I try to push every I try to push it out to my Facebook and my Twitter, but Twitter I'm kind of lacking. But Instagram and Facebook, just at Jill Wagner.
That's good.
And Jill Wagner Official is my Facebook.
That's good stuff. Well, Jill, always great to visit with you, ma'am. I wish you guys a very Merry Christmas. Looking forward to the film and catching up again real soon.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
If there was a Venn diagram set up for laws and ethics, most illegal things would also be morally wrong, so there would be a lot of overlap. But not all wrongs are illegal, and not illegal things are morally wrong. Now, someone recently asked the internet to list things that are illegal but are not ethically wrong. Now, naturally, there was a lot of gray areas and nuances in both what is moral and what is illegal, especially across different regions. Now, that being said, here are 10 highlights. Number 1, paying for someone else's parking meter. Number 2, credentialing laws for things that don't carry much danger if you do them incorrectly. For example, requiring a license to be a florist. Number 3, pirating media that isn't available for purchase in your area. You weren't going to get my money either way, or making photocopies of sheet music. Number 4, loitering in a park. Because, well, you know, the point of a park is to loiter. Number 5, jaywalking and crossing the street on a red light as a pedestrian when there are no cars around. Number 6, withdrawal of care for terminal illness or assisted suicide in general. Number 7, prostitution. Everyone does it for free, so why can't you get paid? Number 8, taking food from an employer when it was about to get thrown away. Number 9, sleeping in your car. And number 10, drinking at 20 years and 364 days. Excited to talk about this movie that's going to be in theaters on Friday called National Champions. And we've got Alexander Ludwig. I could go down the list of things you know him from. Just good to visit with you, brother.
Dude, it's great to be here, man. Thank you so much for having me.
Now tell us, National Champions, I just got done watching the trailer again. And what was it like to be a part of this one? And this is timely story here, brother.
Yeah, you know, for me, that's kind of always been what it's about. Like, I just want to be a part of great stories that I would want to see as a fan. I've certainly never been a part of a story that is as controversial or as topical as this one. So I think that jumping on board to this has just got that extra pressure, and also it just feels really fulfilling because of that. The cast is tremendous, and honestly, I just saw the film, and I'm just so blown away by what everyone was able to bring to it, and I'm really, really proud of it. So I'm really excited to see what people think.
Now, Alexander, tell us about your character in the film, and also give our listeners just a little insight into the story, if you will.
Yeah, so this is, it's basically, this story is everything we've been hearing about college athletes being compensated by the NCAA and that whole conversation. This is a dramatized version of that. So it's about a player who is at the height of his abilities as a quarterback. He's about to be drafted number one to the NFL at a $35 million contract and risks it all to boycott their national title game in protest of athletes not being compensated. I play his best friend who does this all with him, and they kind of go head-to-head with the NCAA. My character, Emmett Sunday, is from Lincoln, Nebraska, and isn't going to make it to the NFL, and is kind of dealing with all these injuries he's sustained from playing D1 sport for so long. And it's kind of just left to the wind. So you've got that two best friends who are on totally different sides of the spectrum in terms of the trajectory of their career going head-to-head with the NCAA. And you watch that all play out in front of you. What I love about this film, though, is that we really touch on every question you possibly have. I mean, I'm a dude from Canada. I didn't grow up watching all of this. You know what I mean? So for me, just coming in objectively, I was like, I want to make sure that this is. When I read the script, I realized right off the bat that we really answer all these questions. You hear from the NCAA side, you hear from the college athlete side, and everywhere in between. And that's what I love about this film. And I'm really excited to just, if this sparks somewhat of a conversation, I'm going to be really, really proud. And I mean, I think that's why so many NFL players wanted to be a part of it. We had Russell Wilson coming and do a cameo and so many others who wanted to be a part of it. So it's exciting.
Now, for you, Alexander, you've worked with some amazing cast, but I tell you, the names on the list for this film, what was it like working with the likes of Timothy Oliphant, Uzo Adoba, and so many others that also bought in, like you said, to this script?
I mean, it was tremendous. You know, for I always became an actor to be a part of films like this, and what I love about this so much is that you feel like you're on the edge of the seat your entire time you're watching the film, and there's rarely any football in it. It's almost like The Big Short when you're looking at what happens behind the scenes of all of this, and yet you're so entranced in it. And I really attribute that to all the incredible cast I was surrounded by, getting to work with people who are so seasoned and have done this for so long. It's any dream for an actor, and I'm so grateful that this one came my way.
Also, I know that you're working on Heels, the role of Ace Spade. This has been picked up for another season as well. What's it like in the in-between, not knowing if another season is to follow? What's that like, Alexander?
I mean, it's pretty brutal, especially when you did what I did, which was buy a house in Georgia in advance. Just, you know, because I was just ready to get out, and I love that the South so much, and just that whole life there. So I was hoping that it was going to get picked up, not only because I love the show, but also because, you know, I want to live there as long as I can. So, we're definitely on the edges of our seat, especially now in television. It takes a while to build an audience. So you really need a studio to believe in you so that you can keep making these seasons. Like, I always go back to Vikings, like, nobody in North America really, well, maybe Canada, nobody in America really talked about Vikings for at least three seasons. And then suddenly it had reached a level that I had never experienced before. And I certainly feel that that's going to be the trajectory of Heels as well. And more importantly than any of that is that I think we made a great show, and I'm really proud to be a part of that one as well.
And Alexander, aside from the acting, the big screen, also music. And how long has the music been a part of your life? And did you ever think that it would be going the way it is now as well?
You know, it's been country music is something that I've loved since I was a kid. I've been playing probably longer than I've been acting. It's just that this kind of took off before the other. And there was really never any time for me to really put all my energy into it. Until I finished Vikings, and I finally started taking trips to Nashville, and you know, I said to myself, this is my chance. I started writing, and that's kind of why I ended up moving to Georgia as well, so I could be as close as I possibly could for the time being, to be able to do this head on. And I'm just so grateful. I can't believe it's happened the way it has, and the response has been so phenomenal. It's hard, you know, in any business when you decide to go to a different line of work. You risk people not taking you seriously or seeing that, oh, this guy isn't real, this isn't authentic. But I think that everyone in Nashville at least saw that this is so much a part of my life and always has been. It's just now I'm finally being given the opportunity to do it on a big scale, which is amazing.
That's awesome. And again, the new movie available in theaters this Friday, National Champions, also the series Heels on Stars. And Alexander, I want to make sure and let folks know where they can keep up with all of your projects and also your upcoming releases as well, brother.
Oh, thanks, man. I mean, honestly, I think Instagram now is the best place to be. So it's just my name on Instagram. So if you look up Alexander Ludwig, that's usually where I'll post all the stuff we got coming out.
That's good stuff. Well, again, check out the movie National Champions this weekend. And Alexander, I look forward to catching up in the new year, my friend.
Thanks so much, man. Have a great holiday.
A new study found that if you want to get ahead at work, you can't just point out what's wrong and how to fix it. You might need to coddle your coworkers and be supportive of their work, even if it sucks. Now, researchers at Iowa State found that using a supportive tone, which they called supportive voice, tends to be better than a challenging voice. Challenging voice means you put out what's wrong and how to fix it. Supportive voice means you still do that, but in a way that's more positive and focuses on what's going right. Now, they found that using a challenging tone does have its benefits, like making you seem more competent and capable. But we're more likely to want to work and collaborate with people who approach things in a supportive way. Ideally, you'd have a perfect mix of both. It's just hard to do, so trying to be more supportive is a good default. Chris Johnson making a return visit, and Mariana Tosca, we've visited social media-wise over the last year and having an opportunity, especially on Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, have a chance to visit about Journey to Royal and how that kind of applies to Pearl Harbor Day and also the whole process behind the film. We'll visit with Mariana and Chris. First off, appreciate you guys for taking the time to be on the show.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, Chris, we talked, I think it was about 8 months ago, 8 or 9 months ago, we talked about this the first time. And the process of the film, I wanted to talk about how long the process was from the original concept until the one that everybody's having the opportunity to watch now.
Well, Cameron, normally a film, at least in my experience, a scripted narrative feature for me takes about 3 years. So it's got the development and, you know, you come up with the idea and you write and you start to put the pieces together and then you shoot and post and then get it out. That process normally takes about, I've found it to be about 3 years. Journey Royal was an entirely different beast because not only is it a documentary format and narrative hybrid, but the people that we were trying to find, these World War II veterans, it's not like you and I and Mariana were all on social media. So, you know, you do a quick Google search and up pops the person, you reach out to them and you're in touch quickly. Mariana had to, well, both of us, but to a large extent, Mariana did, she was like the FBI. She was, she had to do
this. They missed my calling.
Investigative researching to try to even get to these people to find out where they were, because the records from the 1940s and the veterans from World War II, that's a challenge just to find them off of like an accident report.
Mm-hmm.
So the process took about a decade from concept, you know, the initial conception to Mariana and I teaming up on it and getting the thing, getting to everybody and getting it made. I mean, of course, that's the broad view, and Mariana can speak to some of the, you know, the aspects of producing it and finding these people and things of that nature. But a decade of our lives dedicated to preserving the legacy of these amazing people that we got to meet and spend time with, share their stories.
And Mariana, what was it about Journey to Royal that really gripped you, made you want to be a part of this? What was it about Journey to Royal?
That's an easy question for me to answer. When Chris and I first met, he was telling me a story about his great uncle and his service in the war and a particular incident, the one that claimed his life. And the more I heard about it, the more just enraptured by it I was, because I just couldn't stop thinking about this 22-year-old for lack of a better term, kid who put on his Army Air Corps uniform one day, kissed his wife and his four-day-old daughter goodbye, and never saw them again. And he went off to war and served valiantly with a group of other young guys who were flying into arguably the most treacherous theater in the South Pacific for the sole purpose of saving lives. And they were doing it mostly, for the most part, without any ammunition, any way to protect themselves against enemy fire. And the more I really thought about that, not just as a concept, but I mean, really thought about it, the more gripped I was. And I said, I have to be a part of this. I have to help preserve their legacy and make sure that their sacrifice and their service would not be forgotten. And so I said, I'm on, let's do this thing. And that's how it began. But it was because of their service that I wanted to be a part of this.
And that was a defining aspect, I think, for both of us, Cameron. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful stories to be told, you know, World War II stories and of servicemen that will go on unrecognized, you know. And the thing about this one was that we found compelling was that we hadn't seen anything about people whose service was dedicated strictly to saving lives. You know, that their entire purpose of the war was sort of anathema to what war is. So that was another compelling aspect and something that we hadn't seen at all previous to this picture. I mean, I'm sure I know there's books and I know there are those stories out there, but in terms of a formalized in a sort of film presentation, filmic storytelling, this is, if not the first, certainly among the first.
And I know when we visited before, this is something we did not touch on, but dealing with 1940s style everything, I mean, obviously there's not many of those planes around that you can use to be flying around. And I learned over the last couple of months about your other background of making stuff. And Mariana, I'm going to let you talk about how blown away you are by what Chris is able to come up with.
I become speechless when I think about his skill level and skill sets. There's nothing Chris can't do. As a matter of fact, last night I was talking to a friend of mine and she this has nothing to do with anything. but we were looking online at these little Christmas ornaments and I was going to get her one because she's a huge fan of the show Outlander. And it's an Outlander Christmas ornament. And I was looking at it going, you know what? Chris could make one. It's so much better. So I called him up immediately and I was like, hey, you want to make a Christmas ornament for her? But he was an Imagineer at Disney for a very, very long time. And you don't get to be an Imagineer unless your skill set is really superlative. And so Chris is the guy who I found a lot of the veterans to interview and a lot of the other people who were interviewed in the film, but Chris is really the one who did the research on the specs of the props and like the life rafts and the Mae West vests. And so I really do get speechless when I think about it, Chris, the level of commitment. I don't know if Cameron, you had an opportunity to view the disc of the film, the actual Blu-ray. And if you didn't, we'll send you one. There is a 12-minute featurette at the beginning of the, like on the main menu page, it'll say bonus features. Mm-hmm. And it's called Chasing Clouds. And it's 12 minutes long and I highly recommend anybody watch it because it shows really the level of detail that was put into the creation of all of these things to make sure that we were as historically accurate as we could be. And you'll be able to see Chris in all his glory creating those Mae West vests and the life wraps from scratch. With our little team of elves, we had a couple of elves helping us, but for the most part, it was the mastermind himself.
See, this is the problem, Cameron, with audio-visual presentation of these stories is you can, if it was just audio only, you wouldn't see me squirm, you know. It's, but we then get into the Mutual Admiration Society because, you know, it's the thing about it is nice as those things are to hear. The efforts Mariana, myself, and by extension everybody else that worked on the picture our dedication to the thing was in service to the stories of the veterans. And you know, it's very easy to sort of look at something like a life raft or a prop or a plane and say, oh, that's cool, I can see the visual representation of hours of work, okay? But it's more challenging to look at a cast member and think, oh, wait, that was one of 1,500 auditions that Mariana sifted through and audition tapes that that she, you know, groomed down to 50 people that then, you know, I had the opportunity to sit with her and look through these, or the weeks and weeks and weeks of telephone or internet searches, or, you know, reaching out to find the fact that somebody is actually in the picture. I mean, you take it for granted. You look, oh, there's a veteran who survived Pearl Harbor or the USS Indianapolis, things like that. But and it's easy to take for granted. Whereas if you see like a spectacular visual of a plane or that you don't know, perhaps is a miniature or a vest or a life raft that was completed from scratch or repurposed, you know, those things are easier to quantify. But Mariana's participation, you know, it always seems very lopsided to me because we're talking about life vests or, you know, models and things like, you know, things that Imagineers inherently, you know, gravitate to. But the truth is that everybody, we broke up the aspects of the production as to, you know, what our strengths were, and they all overlapped. I mean, Mariana was working on all of the things that I was working on and vice versa. And it was truly a shared effort, and everybody's, you know, certainly Mariana's, my fingerprints are on every aspect of the picture. And, you know, we had the benefit of working with some wonderful technicians and a great cast, in some very challenging scenarios. So, I know that we have a mutual love of everybody that worked on the picture and on this adventure with us.
Now, what has it been like, Chris? We talked before this was out for folks to be able to intake it. What's it been like since having it out there, getting the responses back? Chris, I'll ask you first, and then I'll let Mariana share her thoughts on that as well.
Well, Cameron, this is it's been a strange couple of years for the world, right? Because of the obvious things, the pandemic, things like that, and we're all doing a pandemic film release for the first time in our lives. So it's almost like doing something blindfolded that you're familiar with in that you're feeling your way through it. And so the usual channels and the usual access to things has been a little bit more challenging. So we got the film was supposed to come out in 2020, okay, because it was the 75th anniversary of the events of that are depicted in the picture and the end of the war. And so it got pushed back to February of this year, and it just came out in England under the title Rescue Squadron in September. But we were able to get it out, and we're you know, doing the promotion for it. And I think that we've been so busy with that aspect of trying to do the grassroots representing the picture that we haven't had a lot of time to sit back and ask, how does this feel or what does this mean to us personally? We are, I think thankful that the response seems to be overwhelmingly positive, and people seem to gravitate toward the design of the picture, which is to first and foremost preserve the legacy and the stories of these veterans. And that seems to be, as it rightfully should be, taking the lead and the response to the picture. And the cinematic aspects of it, the narrative feature film parts that sort of dramatize the aspects like the rescue and the B-29 going down, They do get mentioned, but they are, I think they're seen, again, rightfully so, as a component to the telling of the veterans' stories. So I guess that's a long way of saying that it's been a remarkable time under this sort of pandemic release, and it's been gratifying that the film has been able to get out to see audiences, and we're thankful that people seem to be responding in a positive way to the picture and the veterans' stories. And that Mariana, I'm sure, has a...
He checked all the boxes. That was it. He checked all the boxes. The only thing I think I would add is that I'm thrilled that the families of the veterans who appear in our film have responded the way they have. They're so... We say this a lot in interviews. There's this overwhelming kind of current of gratitude that it's reciprocated. We were always deeply, deeply grateful to the veterans for appearing in the film and sharing their stories. And the families of these people ended up across the board always thanking us for making sure that their stories were archived. So it's, for me, that's like the crowning glory. It doesn't get any better than that. I wish that more people knew about the film. So thank you very much for helping us make some noise about it. It's not a big blockbuster, huge, tentpole film, but I do believe it has incredible value. Archivally and just on a human level. I wish more people knew about it, and we're going to keep plugging to that end. But the response so far has been really, really positive, and I couldn't be happier.
Now, Chris, we talked about your work on set, doing all kinds of extras as well. With this being a period piece, what were the challenges of making it look period? I mean, how much different is the challenge doing that as opposed to trying to get all sci-fi in it, if you will?
Well, you couple that with the fact that, as Mariana said, it's not a blockbuster. We didn't have a blockbuster budget, and you're always working in a way to try to present the material in a way that doesn't reveal the amount that, obviously you want it to look as high, as polished and beautiful as you can visually, and have the narrative visual impact that you're going for. But this comes in the design phase, and Mariana and I spoke at great lengths about how we would represent the different aspects of the picture. And if we take it from start to finish, the props and the planes and stuff, I mean, that stuff is all the obvious stuff, right? But as you get into the post-production, we would put together, Mariana and I would sit, and we would develop what are called style boards. And there's a process after you lock a picture called color grading, where you go in and you create a digital internegative, which is just a technical way of saying you go in and every single shot you've done in the picture comes up on the screen, and you work with the colorist. And we sit in a room with a color a monitor that has been dialed in to be as accurate as you can get. And we then go and we literally color the film to the design that we think will have the emotional impact, the emotional subconscious impact of what does it feel like to be in the 40s, or what do we want the interviews to feel like? And that sounds pretty basic, but we would go in during the day, and she can speak to this in some detail here in a second, but we would have a meeting after, and we would have snapshots from the frames of the day. I'm like, does this give us the feeling of 1940? Because we shot digitally, the grain structure, there's the design of the grain structure, the color of the grain, the size of the grain, the movement of the grain, the softness of the edges, the yellows and the life vest, the saturation. These are all sort of boring technical things that that you have to contend with. And especially during a pandemic, Mariana.
I was just about to say, during a pandemic, it made it all the more challenging because you typically have to be in the same room with the color artist. And this was at the height of the COVID frenzy. And
the first wave, right? It was like right in the middle of the first wave.
Before any vaccinations. And so so we could not be in the same room with our color artist. And that was not the best situation. But we pushed through it and we managed to get it done. I don't think I would choose to do it that way again, but we really didn't have a choice in the matter. And the same thing happened with our sound engineer. That was interesting because you really do need to be in the room for that. And we ended up having to strangely remove a wall so that we could be socially distanced and still be in the directional line of the sound for it. So that was interesting. what else, Chris? What else can we say about that color grading process?
I mean, Cameron, again, you look, there's the interview sections and then there's the the dramatic feature film sections, the narrative sections. And we knew that that we wanted the viewer to feel transported in time. We wanted it to feel very different when you were seeing, you know, the veterans speak versus when we were immersed in the, being on a B-29 or a PBY or out in the open ocean. But we didn't want it to be so jarring that because they intermix occasionally in the picture, the interviews and the dramatizations, we didn't want it to be startling so that it took you out. And we also didn't want it to feel overproduced in terms of the interview sections, the documentary sections. We wanted the viewer to be able to feel like we're sitting in the room with them, listening to Grandpa talk about his experiences during World War II. And sometimes, if you overproduce that, there starts to be a disconnect, because it becomes about technique as opposed to being homey and sort of Rockwellian. And we wanted it to feel like a warm hug, like these people were inviting us into their homes and we're in the living room, they're in their most comfortable chair, and we're about to go on this remarkable journey to hear about what it was like to be in the open ocean for 5 days with the USS Indianapolis. Or, as we're on the 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor here, talking to one of Mariana's favorite people, George Keane.
George Keane. That cutie patootie who
survived Pearl Harbor, and that was Mariana, you speak to what it was like to be with George and his wife and the family. And
George, for me, I loved all of the veterans in the film, but there were two or three that really stood out for me. For some reason, I just really connected with them, and George was one of them. And I just remember how his whole family came into the room. His daughters were there. His wife was there. And this was not the exception to our experience, but the majority of the time, the people that were in the rooms had never heard the stories before. For whatever reason, the veterans hadn't chosen to share them before, but we were able to provide them with, I guess, a safe place for them to open up. And again, it goes back to that feeling of gratitude. That's what we were being thanked for. And it just felt, the first couple of times, it felt very odd, like, no, we're the ones that are grateful to you, please. But I did come to understand what they were talking about. And there were, in George's case, I'll get back to him because I'm jumping around. One of the stories he was telling about Pearl Harbor, he had preserved a piece of flak that he had been hit with. And in grabbing it to show it to us, just in the picking up of that little piece of flak, I could see he was emotionally transported back to that time. It was instant. It was absolutely instant. And he became very, very emotional. And there was just a sweetness and a gentleness to him. And I say was because we lost him, but a few weeks ago. He was the last remaining veteran that we had, that we had interviewed who was still alive. So it hurts my heart to say that, but I remember during the interview, he was talking about serving on the USS Hopkins, and that ship had made it through the entire war and had only lost one guy. And he said that after the war, because number 13 was what was on the ship. And he said after the war, number 13 became his lucky number because of that, which I thought was very sweet. My mind had jumped to another veteran as well, who was Lyle Umenhofer, and he was our USS Indianapolis survivor. And he was another one of my favorite people to speak to. There was just this, Cameron, there was a sense of humility about all these guys. It always amazed me. They were in the middle of some of the most dramatic, just exceptional events of in history, really. And they were talking about these events so with such humility and such, without any pomp and circumstance, as if it was just their duty. There was nothing special about what they did. None of them felt that they had done anything special, which just blows my mind. But with Lyle, I mean, you know the story of the Indianapolis. I mean, 5 days of water. My God, with just sharks and barracuda, just ubiquitous, just bumping up against you the entire time, and just not knowing if you were going to be saved. I don't personally think I could have survived something like that. And yet, we were in the room with these guys who had. So anyway, I went down a rabbit hole with that. But yes, George,
you talk about these veterans, and then you look at the fact that you're producing a 90-minute window into this story, and you want to flavor it with all the highlights of the aspects of these different people. And we had 600 pages of transcription, of these different interviews. And you know how it is. I mean, you do these on a daily basis, and you've got to cut this for your audience and keep it pertinent and interesting and flowing. The thing is that with these veterans that we found, that there's so many aspects to their stories, we could have made a mini series with literally the footage and the stories that we have from these interviews. Condensing it down to a 90-minute narrative for the type of picture that we were making and for the distribution window and requirements, you do a film like this that's 2 hours or 2 hours and 20 minutes, you start to lose attention spans just by nature of the fact of what it is and the ADD that social media has given to all of us, right? Our attention span has gotten so much shorter. But there's so many different aspects of these things. I mean, George Keane alone could be a segment talking about Pearl Harbor and the fact that certain people thought that this was going to happen and that there was chatter about it and what that made him feel like and where he was when, the unfolding of it. And then the telling of the thing that, it's the aspects that are so well known throughout history. Those of course are compelling, but it's all the minutiae around that is what we got from these veterans that was so interesting. We got personal, how did it make people feel? Like what was running through a person's head as this thing was happening? Like we could imagine from our standpoint,
right?
Like, oh, what would it be like to be in that scenario? But to hear it from somebody who is in a contemporaneous position to sense and feel and smell and see and hear, it, even to this moment, it moves me to tears, you know, and that's another disadvantage of this visual thing is we end up getting emotional about these people because speaking to them, it was like coming home in every instance. They welcomed us into their homes and made us feel as if we were a part of their family and shared with us things that, as Mariana said, that they hadn't spoken of in front of their family, and many times, often ever. And the film was the catalyst that gave them license to, with purpose, to speak about something so that it, you know, it circumvented in many cases whatever barriers they would normally have to revealing things that they, in many cases, just never wanted to speak about or remember. And then, of course, there, you know, war being, it becomes a dramatized storytelling thing in Hollywood, especially, you know. So the experience of seeing a film about a war is very different. Our appreciation for the actual horror of what war represents was put into a different relief after we spoke with these people. In fact, yep. Mariana, you remember when we would initially speak to these people, we were very eager. Oh,
we would bound into the room like Tigger, just so excited with endless enthusiasm. And pretty soon we came to the realization that we had to really pull the reins back on that because from our perspective, we were in the room with these heroes and getting these stories, but you know, we had to really come to the realization that they were going to be sharing with us and reliving perhaps the most traumatic experiences of their lives. So when you were speaking, I remembered one of the other really remarkable things that happened was there was a family of one of the vets who they had not been in the same room with each other in decades because there was a huge family rift. And they came together for this interview. We were interviewing, one of the vets for it. And to see them all come into the room and kind of as the interview process went on, you could visibly see a softening of the edges around these people. And it was palliative in a way. It kind of took those hard edges away. And by the end of it, they had kind of rekindled a family fire that had somewhat, been extinguished. So that was extremely gratifying for me to see that.
And the reason for that, Cameron, was, we lived these things. So to the audience, it might not be obvious, but yeah. The war had created, the traumas of the war had created certain behaviors in, the veteran and had caused strife. And the family, who isn't necessarily privy to those traumas, didn't understand the change in the husband and the father. And the father not necessarily wanting or being able to communicate what that PTSD had done to them or, overcome it in a way that was readily accessible. The treatments and things, especially back then, they weren't what our awareness isn't mm-hmm. what it is now. And so what Mariana is speaking to is the fact that the palliative aspect of and the healing aspect of everybody being in the same room and hearing these things for the first time gave them insights. And like it was like markers along the way of their lives to say, oh, this is why this happened. This is why he did this. This is why he couldn't talk about this. And this is why he behaved this way about, X, Y, Z. And so as that understanding happened, the softening that she spoke to occurred. And at the end, it was remarkable to see the change in disposition and closeness of the family, that those barriers had been, if not removed, softened to the point where that awareness was palpable in the room. Mm-hmm. And they thanked us for that. And Again, we both feel that's a misplaced gratitude, because our gratitude is that they had the courage to come together and to encourage the sharing of these stories. They didn't realize it at the moment, but they were the engines of their own healing. And we just were in the lucky position to bear witness to it and record it and to share with the picture, you know, the aspects that applied to the picture.
Well, that's awesome. And again, the documentary we've been talking about, Journey to Royal, it's a World War II rescue mission. Chris and Mariana, I want to make sure and let our listeners know, where's the best place to, if they haven't viewed it yet, to check it out. And then, of course, follow everything else you guys have got going with other projects as well.
Well, you can go to the website, which is journeytoroyal.com. If you'd like to purchase a Blu-ray, you can, or a DVD, you can do it through the website. It's also on, my gosh, Amazon Prime. If you have a subscription to that, you can see it for free. Where else is it? Google Play? Vudu?
The website has a portal where you can click on and see all of the different places domestically you can see it, right? So it's like one-stop shopping, essentially. And you go to the website.
And then if you're in the UK, actually, it's under a different title. It's called Rescue Squadron there. So just wanted to throw that out in case anybody in the UK is watching. Sorry, Chris, didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I interrupted initially. We offer Blu-rays and DVDs through there's a portal on the website, and we personalize them. I realize we're not Kathleen Kennedy or Steven Spielberg or anything, but for people who order it through our website versus Amazon or any of the other fine retailers, we write a note on the Blu-ray and send along a little 6x9 poster card with a note on the back. And it's not that it has some great collectible value or anything, but it's an extension of the family feeling and the atmosphere and the personalization of what this film means to us collectively, you know, for the entirety of the veterans and the cast and the crew. And we like to make it even more personal than, you know, you're free to order wherever it's best for you. It's just that's one of the things that we offer through the website. And of course, streaming, the only disadvantage of streaming is that you don't get the,
bonus feature of behind the scenes.
All right. Well, again, journeytoroyal.com. And I already lost the one in the UK, Mariana.
Oh, it's Rescue Squadron.
There you go. She had to have my back. I appreciate that. There you go. How about that?
it's a very similar, but in the US here.
Chris, if you drop your left hand, we have the poster behind you.
There you go.
See, this is the way the whole interview should have gone, right?
That's awesome. Well, Mariana and Chris, it has been great to visit with you. Mariana, nice to officially meet you face to face. And Chris, it's always great to visit with you. And I'm looking forward to spending some more time with this on Pearl Harbor Day today. And hopefully, guys, we can catch up again in the new year.
Oh, I would love that. Please, let's do that. Let's make sure to do that, Cameron.
Absolute pleasure, as always. And just real quick before we go, I know both Mariana and I, we always extend our most heartfelt gratitude to the men and women of service who previously and who are currently serving, especially on this 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
Well, thanks again for joining us for this 159th episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. If you ever have a comment, question, maybe anything else you'd like to know, you can hit me up on the contact page at gqwithcam.com. You can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Facebook at gqwithcam. If you'd like to help out in the funding for this podcast, you can visit our merch store where we've got hoodies, shirts, tumblers, mugs, stickers, backpacks, lots more, gqwithcam.com/shop. And if you have a special guest idea, email me, Cameron@GQWithCam.com. Do want to say thanks again to our good friend Brandon Allen for coming up with our theme music. We're going to let him play us out and hope you guys have a great rest of your evening.